Welcome back to Brandon Wilborn's Fantasy Fiction Podcast, where fans of classic fantasy adventures can hear the serialized audiobooks of a fellow nerd and indie author completely for free. Okay, that's not my real voice. I'm your narrator, author, host, and nerd, Brandon Wilborn, and, thanks for listening today. It's a busy week and a season. It's coming into the holidays, so thanks for being with me. I hope that this gives you a little bit of fun and escape as you try to get all your shopping done this year. Or if you're listening at another time of year because this is on the internet and it lasts forever, then I still hope it gives you some fun and escape and maybe gives you something to think about. The story portion of this episode starts about the 220 mark if you want to skip all the other stuff. Man, I can see the end of this story. Actually, quite literally, I can see the end. I've had to scroll down in my software I'm recording with, and I can see the table of contents where there's just a few more chapters to read. So I hope you're ready. This is going to be finishing up here soon. And once it's done, this is going to get compiled and be available in audiobook format very soon after the podcast is completed or after the recording is completed. So I do hope that you will support us there. If you've been enjoying the podcast, that you would go ahead and just order an audiobook copy so you can binge to your heart's content, and obviously to share if you've got that chance. Or most likely you're listening in the future, and you can go ahead and listen right now as much as you want. You can binge all you want, and you can have your own copy of just the story without me talking at the front or the back and enjoy the story by itself. So I think it's time for a recap. Last time in the Treasure of Caprick, Kurian reunited with some old allies and figured out that there's some changes going on with his relationships. They were pursued briefly as they tried to sneak around the city of Duri, only to be rescued and then carried along as the river burst forth again. This week I'll be reading chapter 28, and that'll be it, nothing after the story. Now I present for your enjoyment The Treasure of Caprick. Chapter 28. Awakening Apaford. Gideon's enormous horses were impossibly fast. They galloped along without tiring, almost without seeming to touch the ground. The heavy hoofbeats Kurian was expecting became only a light patter, barely audible above the sound of the wind in his ears, and the sound of that gale came in great rhythmic gusts, like the beating of enormous wings. With each flurry, the horse skimmed over the earth as if they floated on invisible pinions. The flood of the river surged ahead, faster than any horse could possibly run for so long, and yet they kept pace with it, following less than a mile behind. The ruins of Finn appeared on the horizon, and before Kurian realized what they were, he was within the city, and then it was behind him. Then the wonders truly began. The river passed the outlying farms of the old city, which had lain fallow for so long that the grass of the plain had reclaimed them from the feral crops. As glittering waters poured by, Kurian saw the grass darken to a deeper green. Then the fields came to life with tender new shoots that reached above the grass. He watched them climb skyward, growing before his eyes, and by the time they flew by in a blur, heads of grain weighed down their stalks, and entire fields stood ready for harvest. It continued mile after mile. The fields sprouted and matured in minutes. Decrepit orchards that had already lost their leaves in the October chill nearly exploded with new foliage, blossomed for an instant, and then drooped lower and lower, their branches laden with fruit. The long, dry artery of the plain of Apos flowed once again with life-giving water. After long years of restraint, when it was only allowed to sip a few drops of rain, the land drank deeply and was satisfied. With its life-blood pouring forth again, it shrugged off the death of autumn and the accumulated decay from a century of darkness. In each moment, the world became more fully alive. Birds sang and flitted through the new growth with the same vigor that came after a long winter thaw. The air warmed and became saturated with the perfumes of spring, summer, and harvest all rolling together, bringing with them a bouquet of joyful memories. It was thaumaturgy at its best. With each new green shoot, every fresh sensation of life,
Kurian's hope grew until it bloomed into a confident assurance, and he felt incapable of doubt. They would face Evasius, and the power his family had seized so long ago would fail. The hope of Finn could be reborn. Then the people might follow the land's example, finding restoration and life. Nobody in Apaford saw them riding in from the north, all eyes fixed on the floodhead roaring past. Its height had diminished on the 80-league journey so that it barely washed over the top of the old stone bridge, but to people who had never seen anything but a dry riverbed, it was an unbelievable sight. It wasn't until the five riders slowed down and their mounts returned to the normal thud of galloping horses that anyone noticed them. More people than usual milled about the edge of town, looking up into the rich blue sky, or staring at the river. From their expressions, Kurian thought they barely believed the vision of armed riders coming down upon them. It was too much for these old, frail, sick people. "Perhaps they think the end has finally come," he thought. But before he could think too much about their condition, his horse stood among them, and he was shouting through wind-cracked lips, "Where is the mayor?" The people standing near them either cowered away in fear, or came close to examine these strange, shining riders as if they were ghosts. One old man, who he recognized as Mr. Baker, stepped close with dazed eyes and gingerly reached out to touch the bridle of his horse. "Mr. Baker," he said, leaping down from the saddle.
"Are we dead?"
said Mr. Baker, looking around confused.
"Is this paradise? It looks so beautiful. Look."
He pointed at the river.
"The river is back."
"You're not dead, Mr. Baker. At least not yet," he thought. Kurian grabbed his shoulders and forced him to look at his face. "It's Kurian Abramson, Mr. Baker. Do you remember me? My father is Jeremiah." Recognition suddenly dawned on the pale, wrinkled face, and he smiled.
"Little Kurian,"
he said.
"My, you've grown. You look like a proper knight in that suit."
"Thank you, Mr. Baker, but I need to find the mayor."
"Oh, there's been no mayor here since you were a boy," said Mr. Baker. "Everybody minds their own business. We're all too old and tired to cause trouble."
"Then nobody is in charge?"
"Looks like you are," Reese joked.
Gideon walked his horse into the center of the crowd and blew a long, clear note on an old hunting horn. More people were coming from the center of town to see the spectacle. Soon he had a small but growing crowd gathered, staring at the three young men in bright armor and their strangely dissimilar companions. Gideon motioned for Kurian to get on his horse and join him. When they sat side by side, he turned to the crowd and began to speak in his cavernous voice, which rose and carried over the entire village.
"Hear me, people of Apaford, and mark the signs of this wondrous day. For the sky veiled to your fathers and grandfathers has been revealed to you. You are the generation blessed to feel the warmth of the sun after a long cold night. The Apos, for so long a dry bed of death, flows again with life-giving water. Look and see how your orchards and groves thrive out of season. Finally, your own son returns, having been declared the chosen heir to the throne of Finn and all this land. He comes to free you from the oppression of Lord Evasius, and to return this to a place of peace, prosperity, and goodness. Behold King Kurian."
Gideon held out a hand toward Kurian, and the crowd stared, speechless. In the silence, a stooped woman with skin like that of a dried-out potato said,
"Huh! My grandam always said this would happen, and here's the river and the king on the same day."
She finished with a bemused laugh, and then the entire crowd was in uproar. Some bowed in fearful submission, as they would to Lord Evasius or the other royals. Most were trying to shout their own questions above the others.
"How do we know he's king?"
was the loudest. Gideon gestured to the river.
"Isn't that enough of a sign for you?"
he bellowed. His voice overpowered the others, and the crowd fell silent again.
"If not, then taste of it yourselves. Wade into it and cleanse yourselves of a lifetime of despair. May God strike me if it does not uplift your body and your spirit."
This set the crowd into a new commotion. One or two ventured carefully near the river bank, while anyone standing near Gideon's horse backed away in fear and suspicion. Kurian glanced at Tobin and Rhys, then let his gaze linger on Louise. They offered only helpless shrugs.
"Friends,"
Kurian shouted as loudly as he could. In the quieting crowd there were several hushes.
"The boy king wants to talk," said a heckler.
"Please do not bow in fear of me," he said first to those on their knees. "And do not simply accept my friend's word and give me honor that I have not earned. Many of you knew me as a boy, and you saw me sometimes as a novitiate of the Caprix. Now I would like to earn your respect and trust as a leader, and perhaps some day as a king. For now, I have no throne."
This got a chuckle from some. "But one with even greater authority has called me to that task, and with every ounce of my life, I would like to see the glory of Finn restored, even surpassed." Every eye was on him, though some were enthralled while others were suspicious. In the pause, a woman shouted from the riverside. It surprised everyone, and their attention turned to a single figure, kneeling on the shallow bank, lifting a handful of water to his lips. The shout had come from a woman standing nearby, holding her hands to her mouth.
"It's the sweetest, freshest water I've ever tasted," called the kneeling man.
The crowd murmured. He laughed and then took another drink. Finally, he jumped knee-deep into the river and began splashing about and beckoning for others to join him. The few people who stood near him stepped closer with curious looks. The old woman with the crinkled potato skin hobbled forward on weak legs until she stood deep in the current and could drink without bending. Everyone watched in silence as this matriarch slowly drank her fill. When she finished, she lifted her head and stood straighter than before, and then turned around. Her hair looked a touch darker and her skin smoother to those close enough to notice. But they all saw that she stood tall and strong, unlike the frail creature they had known for years. She looked at her hands and arms, then giggled. Finally, she strode from the water and began to dance, flinging water all over those who bunched around her. Her laughter continued like music in the air. Those who had been tentative now rushed toward the river.
"You don't have to believe in me," Kurian said, "but believe the one who sent the water, and trust that I truly want to free you from Evasius's tyranny."
"What does that have to do with us?"
said the heckler.
"Everything," Gideon said, "for he comes against you even now. His troops could arrive at any moment."
Kurian and his friends stared incredulously at him.
"Right on time, huh?"
Louise said dryly. Gideon tried to suppress a smirk and shrugged.
"Well, it's a good thing we have some time to prepare,"
Tobin said, but it was impossible to tell whether he was joining in the joke or genuinely worried. More people stepped out of the river, celebrating the healing and rejuvenation they received from the water. Amid their shouts, the rush of the current seemed to beckon Kurian, offering to soothe his parched tongue. He nudged his horse forward and slipped from the saddle. His boots pressed firmly into the damp, sandy silt of the bank, and he kneeled down to drink. The water was as pure and cold as the sips he had taken from the fountain in the king's camp. It refreshed him in the same way, and he was certain that it was somehow from the same source. When he rose, the weariness of the long journey and the long night fled from his body. He turned back toward the crowd with a fire kindled in his heart, and he knew it showed in his eyes when those who had appeared most suspicious looked on him with burgeoning respect.
"We know Evasius is coming," he said. "We don't know how many soldiers he brings. We must prepare. Any ideas?"
Tobin spoke up immediately.
"If everyone in town could fight, we would have maybe 500. When they sacked the compound, Evasius brought only a few hundred mounted soldiers. We might outnumber him."
"But look at them," Rhys said. "We can't face trained soldiers in open battle, even if we outnumber them, and especially if they're mounted."
Louise and Gideon agreed.
"I'm merely thinking through our numbers," said Tobin,
exasperated at the interruption.
"And you're right. However, the streets are narrow enough that, if we can draw them in, it forces Evasius into a spot where he can't maneuver."
He surveyed the town's exposed mortar and aging thatch.
"Maybe we split up, hide in the buildings so the town looks deserted, then shoot or drop whatever we can on the passing soldiers. Small groups run up the side alleys to skirmish with the soldiers, and then draw his force apart. We set traps and lead them there. We wear them down until they leave.
Gideon and Rhys both nodded.
We will lose many, Gideon said. But I like this plan. It gives us the advantage of surprise.
We just have to hope they don't raise the town with all of us hiding inside, Louise shouted.
The crowd jumped at her outburst and began to mutter nervously again. Corian lifted himself into the saddle again.
Tobin, he said, normally I would accept your plan as the best chance for success, but I have a feeling that today's battle won't be about numbers and tactics.
What does that mean? Tobin asked.
The king told us that help would come, Corian said,
as much to the crowd as to Tobin.
And look what's happened. I know he sent the water, and look what it's done to everyone and everything it touches. He'll send the help we need to fight Evasius, too. I don't know how I know, but I know it deeply.
Tobin clearly struggled with this answer before asking,
Then what do we do?
Corian smiled the way he used to when trying to convince Tobin to bend the rules. It was so transparently manipulative that it still somehow charmed his friend every time.
We have faith, he said, turning the tables.
Great.
Tobin rolled his eyes the way he always had when he gave in. Louise laughed in surprise behind Tobin and looked like she was about to cry. Yes, she was different. Figuring out how would have to wait.
If you are fearful, we will not hold that against you, Corian said to the crowd. Anybody who wishes to flee may do so without any threat of retribution.
Corian found that the words came easily, as if someone whispered them into his soul, and they overflowed through his mouth. A few began trotting back to their houses.
But if you would fight for your life, and your homes, and your freedom, then stand with us. Who would help us bring down the tyrant Evasius?
A few brave souls, mostly those who had already been to the river, raised their hands.
If you fear, or if you doubt, you are free to find your own way. For your fear will only spread, and your doubt will weaken us. However, if there is a seed of trust within you, then go to the river. Drink so that seed may grow. Wash so you may be restored. Then join us. We make our stand on the bridge.
Finally, an open fight,
Rhys said with sudden zeal.
We'll probably all die, but it's worth it to poke a stick in the eye of the man who killed our brothers.
But first, we get everyone we can into the river, Corian said. I don't care if Evasius comes over Capric Hill. They are our first priority.
He pointed to the crowd. Fewer than 100 stood around him, but most of those now looked on him with trust and began to make their way to the riverside. Somewhere in the village were 400 others who either would not or could not make it out to witness the sky and the river, or to hear his speech. He instructed Gideon and Rhys to help guide the efforts and to find those still in the village. He asked Tobin and Louise to go with him. They could leave the riverside for a few moments, since every person coming out from the river was another helper for the relief mission.
Where are you going?
Gideon asked after dismounting.
I must see my father.
He raised a hand to knock on the door of his childhood home and remembered that this had been where he stood when Evasius first attacked the compound and uprooted his life. What he had not thought then in his juvenile frustration was that his father might not live here, might even have died. He would not have known, since the order felt no compulsion to inform the brothers of family deaths. They were supposed to have severed those ties when they took their oath. He recognized now that his situation had been unique among the brothers. No others had family living close enough that they might bump into them regularly. He had last spoken to his father when he was 12. After 5 years of confinement in the compound. He'd last seen his father from a distance in town over 3 years later. He remembered seeing the familiar leather bag, bulging at odd angles, hanging at his father's side, the wooden mallet still poking out from the top. His young heart leapt when he saw that bag and recognized the figure holding it. But his father had not seen him that day, and he had not seen his father again. A terrible thought crossed his mind.
Perhaps the Aura didn't like me seeing him, and told him to leave me alone to focus on my training.
He could imagine the Dean convincing his father to disappear from his sight. For his own good, of course. What did it do to him to agree to that? That was the thought that made him pause when his hand poised to knock. Then he forgot about formalities and lifted the catch on the door. Tobin and Louise entered silently behind him. Inside, the light was dim, and a musty odor filled the room. Clearly someone still lived there, because a fire burned in the hearth. But the room was disheveled, and it did not look like food had been prepared in the kitchen for some time. The only neat and tidy place was the corner where his father's tools and workbench stood in perfect order. A small pile of unfinished shoes sat on the floor, and above them hung the leather satchel, now a little more worn than in his memory. He called and heard movement upstairs. He took the stairs to the small bedrooms above and found his father lying in bed. He had never been a particularly large man, but he had always been strong and healthy. Now he was gaunt, and his face looked waxy and pale in the strong light coming through the windows. Kurian kneeled at the bedside, and when recognition dawned in his father's eyes, they welled with tears, and a smile twitched at his mouth.
"My boy," said his father in a cracked voice, "they told me you died."
"I've come home, Papa."
"How?"
"It's a long story, one I hope we'll have time for later."
His father reached out and felt his armor.
"New uniform?"
he asked, puzzled.
"Where are your robes?"
"The Order is no more."
Kurian had to fight back his own tears.
"Only Dean Goodman survived. My two friends and I were sent to negotiate with Lord Evasius, so we also escaped. But now we have found a new mission."
"You look like a lord yourself in that armor,"
his father said, and let his head fall back with a satisfied smile.
"I knew you would be something great one day."
The questions in his mind lost the anger behind them when he saw his father's pride, but he still needed to ask them.
"I don't understand," he said gently. "You must have seen that the Capricks weren't like all your stories anymore. How could leaving me with them lead to something great if they were only a shadow of their past?"
"Because I knew you, son."
His father coughed, adding to the bloodstains on his pillow. Kurian looked back at Tobin and Louise with concern, but he knew they were not healers like the king.
"It didn't matter if their glory was gone. God put greatness in you. I knew you could become a man like the ones in their stories, even if they were not. But a cobbler could not teach you how to fight or to think. I could not teach you about the bravery and sacrifice that makes a man heroic."
"But you did, Papa," Kurian said. "Your stories kept me in the Order when I wanted to run away. They made me so determined to protect their treasure that when it disappeared I would do anything to find it. I almost lost myself. I think I passed through death before I did find it."
"Then you've done more than I could have dreamed,"
his father said.
"Did you know about our family? That we're related to the old kings?"
The old cobbler opened his mouth to speak, but his body convulsed with another coughing fit. He wheezed heavily after it subsided.
"Your mother can't stop smiling at you,"
he managed to say. His mother had died when he was a child.
"Papa, we need to get you down to the river," he said, and tried to lift him into a sitting position.
"No."
"But the river is flowing again. Everyone who goes into it comes out better. They all feel like they're in their prime again."
"See,"
his father said, smiling.
"You're just like the stories I used to tell you. But my time is done. Seeing you like this, it is enough."
He grabbed Kurian's hand from his shoulder and held it firmly while resting his head back on the pillow. Slowly, the firmness of his grip diminished.
"Go, my son,"
he whispered.
"Lead your people."
Then he let out a slow, rasping breath, closed his eyes, and his fingers went slack. Kurian squeezed his hand,
Papa? He grabbed his shoulders and shook them gently. Papa, we can heal you at the river.
Tobin stepped forward and laid a hand on his shoulder.
He's gone, Corian.
No,
Corian said through tears.
I'll carry him to the river. It's a day of miracles. He'll come back.
Corian,
Louise said softly but firmly.
He has done everything he set out to do in this life. I do not believe he would come back even with the river's help. God has called him to rest after finishing his job. Now we must go finish our mission.
Corian wanted to argue, but suddenly he felt the water he had drank from the river coursing through his entire body, now with warmth and revitalizing strength. It calmed his grief and returned the hope and confidence that grew in him on the plains, and the whispers in his spirit, which had guided him all day, told him that she was right. His father had seen his victory, and he would not have to suffer the struggle ahead. The river was not for him, and trying it would only cause more pain. But his father had given him a final gift. He knew why his father had left him with the monks. With those words, he understood that anger and grief did not have to chain his heart any more. He reached out and placed a hand on his father's forehead, saying a silent prayer. Then he said,
"Thank you, Papa,"
and walked back out into the bright sunshine.
The people of Appaford are the first to taste the new life from the river. But how long will it last when Evasius is bearing down on them at any moment? Will they be prepared when his forces arrive? Join me next week as the Treasure of Capric continues. As I said at the beginning, I don't have anything extra for today, but the likelihood is you're listening to this in the future. I am trying to get the audiobook version ready and up available before Christmas of 2023. That's when I'm finishing this. So please go check Amazon, punch in my name, and find out if it's up, and you can order it there. You can order a book, print copy or ebook copy, and hopefully by the time you're listening to this, book two is either well on its way or ready to go. And if you happen to not like Amazon, I do publish wide, so you should be able to find the same books and audiobooks on any other major bookseller that you can find. So I'm not Amazon exclusive, and you'll find a link to all the retailers down in the description, so check that out. I'd love to hear if you have any questions or comments. Again, if you would like to just have your question read on the air, I would love to do that for you. Just go to my website and leave me a voicemail or a text mail. And again, that is, I didn't say it before, but here it is. BrandonWilborn.com/contact. That's Brandon, not Brandoff, and Wilborn is as simple as you can make it. WILBORN. So BrandonWilborn.com/contact. Thanks again for listening to the show. If you're enjoying it or if you've enjoyed it to this point, please give it a 5-star rating and review. Go ahead and then share it with somebody that you care about who you think would love this story too. Together, we can beat the algorithms of our digital overlords and share good stories with each other. That's all for this week. Until next time, Godspeed. The Treasure of Capric is available in print and ebook formats and soon to be audio from all major booksellers. Find a link to your favorite retailer in the show description or go to BrandonWilborn.com. That's Brandon, not Brandoff, and Wilborn is as simple as you can make it. WILBORN. This has been The Treasure of Capric, Book 1 of The King of the Caves, written and narrated by Brandon M. Wilborn. Copyright Brandon M. Wilborn.